quarters continuing studies classes. And there's one class I saw on the calendar that was really interesting. It's about technology, and it's going to be run in the format of this class. And I don't know the individuals involved except for one researcher, BJ Fogg, who's really cool. But if you like this format of class, I did see there's going to be another one like this winter quarter. Okay, so it's my pleasure to introduce Brian Knutson, who is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Stanford and the director of the Symbiotic Project on Affective Neuroscience, which explores what happens in the brain when we're experiencing different emotions and when we're making decisions. He's actually one of the world's leading neuroeconomists. His research has illuminated things like what happens in your brain when you spot a bargain and why it is that sexy photos can make men make more risky investment choices. But it's not all sex and shopping, although that would be good. But not just sex and shopping, he also has a more altruistic side. He has done research for the Stanford Center for Compassion and Altruism, looking at the brain basis of altruism and doing good. And he also is an advisor to a company called Consumerology, which I actually don't know anything about, but I hear that it's a company that uses psychological neuroscience research to help consumers make better healthcare choices. And so I'm hoping we're going to get to talk a little bit about that in our conversation later on. So please join me in welcoming Brian Knutson.
It's always a pleasure to be up on the stage. Kelly and I have taught Psych 1 in this room before when it was older and a little bit rattier. But it's especially a pleasure to be up on the stage tonight because all of you are a much more diverse audience than we're used to in Psych 1. And I'm really looking forward to not only hearing me speak, but hearing you speak and getting your feedback and questions. And by the way, if there's anything that you find puzzling during the talk or that you think you'd like to clarify, just raise your hand. I'm happy to stop and try to clarify. I have no... Yes, Kelly.
Is your microphone on?
Oh, that's... See, there you go. It pays off. It is on now. Okay. Sorry.
Sorry.
So, if you didn't hear that, you didn't miss much. So, I'm going to talk about... The title of my talk is This Is Your Brain on Money. And I'd like to admit up front that I never really was that interested in money. Otherwise, I wouldn't have an advanced degree and be teaching psychology. But it's actually emotion that got me interested in money. And so I am not an economist. I've trained as a psychologist and a neuroscientist. But I have the good fortune of being able to speak to many economists and people in finance and to do research on these topics. And so I'm hoping you'll see at the end of this talk that there really is a consilience and an interesting intersection between our emotional lives and our financial choices. Before I get to that, I'd like to start with what I consider to be a fun image. How many of you recognize this image? Wow, good. I'm not completely dating myself. This is a Nirvana album cover. That's not why I find the image funny. I find it funny because if I threw my kids in the swimming pool and did this, there's no way they would be doing that. They would not swim after the money. They'd scream and kick and cry. I'm not going to do the experiment, but I'm just saying. They would not do that. And so I think that's one reason this is funny. They're kind of making fun of the human propensity to run after money and implying that this is ingrained at a very early age. And I doubt that's the case. We have to learn it. Kids do not salivate when you dangle dollar bills in front of their faces. But many adults will show similar salivatory-like behaviors when they see cues that they might make money. And I want to stress here that it's not just making the money that gets them excited. It's actually seeing signals and signs and cues that indicate that they might make money. Now, this is kind of a critical point in my talk, and it has to do with technological advances that allow us to see what's happening in the brain in real time. And so monetary outcomes can influence our emotions, both for good and for bad, as we've seen in the last decade. And as many of you who look at your stock portfolios on a regular basis maybe feel more like these guys. I know I do. But I want to make this point that it's not just the monetary outcomes that influence us, but really, and maybe on a larger scale, that drive the market, but it's really what we're anticipating might happen. And I also want to make the point that it's not just that we're projecting, we're sort of predicting symbolically, oh, this stock might go up, that might go down, the probability of that happening is X, Y, or Z. It's that we feel something when we're projecting. And the question is, if we do feel something, is that motivating us to do something different than we would normally do? And if you scale that up, can that influence actually things like the market? And so I'd like to start with two dominant models of humans, admittedly oversimplified, but probably not accurate. No one would actually endorse these models, but yet they kind of illustrate two ends of continuum that we have for thinking about humans and how they behave when making decisions, especially financial decisions. The one on the left is the rational actor model. So this model is actually a popular model, contrary to what you might expect. It's widely held in many fields, including my own field, psychology, also in economics and finance. The idea is that people are consistent in their choices. So they, and you may have heard a little bit about this from the previous speaker, Bhavashiv. But the idea is that they, if they prefer apples to oranges today, they will prefer apples to oranges tomorrow. This is a very important, fundamental, axiomatic property of human choice. Second, that humans have unlimited attention, so they can kind of understand everything that's going on and all the options that are out there that are available to them, and take that in and process it. Related to that, they have perfect memory, so they remember everything that happened to them and are able to summon all their preferences in a moment's notice. And finally, because of all these fantastic attributes the rational actor has, the rational actor is unbiased. Now, the rational actor may have preferences, so they may prefer apples to oranges, whereas another rational actor may prefer oranges to apples. But again, those are consistent preferences. They don't flop around, and they're not subject to strange things that happen in the atmosphere, or that happen on this ticker tape, or what they had for lunch, or what their daughter said to them that morning, or anything like that. Okay, so that's one model. Here's another model, the not-so-rational actor. So this actor obviously is different from the rational actor. They are sometimes inconsistent. They suffer from limited attention. They have imperfect memory. And sometimes they're biased, meaning that they're not always consistent. Sometimes they'll choose this way, sometimes they'll choose that way. And sometimes their biases are due to the circumstances that they're in. Now, obviously, we might prefer to be like this rational actor, but if we look at the data, I'm going to contend that some of us are like the not-so-rational actor, and that this is important, because if we are like the not-so-rational actor, even if that evens out at the aggregate, it's still going to ruin your life if you can't predict what you're going to do or going to like, and you make silly decisions that you later regret, okay? And so even if this kind of knowledge about how people are not so rational is not useful at the group level, it may be quite useful to you at the individual level. And I would even submit that part of aging, I hope, is gaining wisdom about how you're not so rational and gaming that system so that you can make choices that are more in line with your rational side. Okay, so this leads to two questions that I'd like to address with you tonight. And these questions form the core of what my lab has been doing for the last 10 years, and really of two emerging fields that lie at the intersection of psychology, neuroscience, and economics. The first question is, which brain mechanisms anticipate good and bad events? Now, if you're thinking about the rational actor, you might think, well, there are cognitive mechanisms, there are representational mechanisms. These mechanisms predict, they symbolically represent, they do the calculations, etc. If you're thinking about the not-so-rational actor, you might be thinking about, well, there are sort of emotional pulls. There's greed and fear. There are things that grab you and push you one way or the other, okay? And this is the subject of a field called affective neuroscience. That is the neuroscience of how emotions work in the brain. And the second set of questions is, if you can identify the brain mechanisms that anticipate good and bad events, does their activity actually influence choice? So maybe then I'm having an emotional reaction, but I'm in complete control. I don't need to pay attention to that. I can overcome it, and I never let it influence me, so I'm always consistent. This is the topic of a field called neuroeconomics. It's sort of at the intersection of neuroscience and economics and some other fields. And I want to point out that just because you solve this problem doesn't mean that necessarily you've solved that problem. Okay? There might be brain mechanisms that anticipate good and bad events, but their activity really has no influence on choice. So it's incumbent upon us as scientists to actually investigate both of these questions and not assume that because we've solved this question, we're going to actually find the solution to that question. And that's why I have this little diagram here. You can think of this as a brain. There's stuff going into the brain, input, sensory information, so forth. There's correlated activity in the brain. And then there's some of that correlated activity actually will allow you to predict what the output will be. But this is sort of the one key feature of thinking like a psychologist is that you don't assume that there's nothing here. So you don't assume that just because I know about the input, I'm going to know what the output is. There's a transformation that's occurring. And part of our job as psychologists is to figure out what the transformation is. And the way that we can use the new techniques like brain imaging to do that is to look for overlap in these circles. What is the input causing? And then of that, what is helping us to predict the output? Yes, question, yeah.
What is correlated activity?
Oh, I'm sorry, that's a jargony term. What that means is that if I shine a light in your eyes, and then I take it away, and I shine it, and take it away, then what I would expect is that some part of your brain will show more activity when the light's on than when it's off. And so that's just one example of that. But it could get fancier, like if I dangle a $5 bill in front of you, and then I take it away, and which you're going to see me do, then some parts of your brain might respond to that as well. Okay, and that brings us to localization, and the idea behind localization, because we really don't know much about the brain, because we really haven't had the tools to look inside the brain at a second-to-second resolution where we can see in millimeter cubes what's going on in your brain until recently, until about 10 years ago. And those methods are still developing. You know, Lima over there runs the imaging facility across the way there, just across the hall, and her cool equipment is allowing us to do this research. So if you have technical questions about it, you can go ask her after the lecture's over. But I want to start further back, not 10 years ago, but 50 years ago, with this picture, which was taken at McGill University by a man named James Olds, who was a social psychologist, who had gone there to work with a neurologist named Donald Hebb. And he really didn't know a whole lot about rats. Hebb had rats, and he said, you know, work with my rats. And so Olds went down to the basement and worked with the rats. His idea was he wanted to stick an electrode in the brain and wake up the rats. And he was working with a physicist named Pete Milner. So Milner knew about electrodes. Olds didn't know about anything. Olds said, stick the electrode in the rat brain. Let's put him on this tabletop and see what he does. So they did that, and they stimulated the rat, and lo and behold, they did not get the desired effect. This is common in psychology, but you know, Olds, being a psychologist, persevered. And he watched what the rat was doing, and he noticed that when he took that rat out of its cage and put it back on the tabletop the next day, it went back to the corner of the table where it had been stimulated the day before. And he said, ah, this is very interesting. What if we let the rat stimulate its own brain? And so that's what this rat is doing here. This rat has a wire sticking out of its head, and it's hooked up to this bar right here. And when the rat presses the bar, then it gets a little jolt of electricity in its brain. And when Olds did this, he found something interesting, that this rat worked very hard to press the bar. And it was not distracted by anything else in the cage. It wasn't distracted by food or water or other attractive rats or even sleep. You know, that would just keep pressing that bar vigorously until it was basically exhausted. This probably sounds to some of you like people on the internet. But that notwithstanding, we haven't done the internet study yet. Olds did not know what was going on, obviously, because he didn't know where the electrode was. He couldn't chop off the rat's head because this was a very valuable rat. I mean, you don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs, right? So how do you figure out where the electrode is? Well, in those days, he took an x-ray of the rat, and that wasn't so good. The resolution wasn't so great. But he found out that the electrode was sort of deep in the brain, below the cortex. Rats have a cortex, actually, just like us. And, well, not exactly, but it's similar. It was below the cortex in a region of the brain that wasn't well understood, the subcortex, and we're going to hear more about that region, because it turns out that a few years later, a Swedish neurochemist figured out that a neurotransmitter called dopamine, this is a cross-section of a cartoon of a human brain, so we chop here, and you look in there, and the eyes are over here, and here's the cortex up here, here's subcortical regions here. These are called dopamine neurons that project from your midbrain up into subcortical regions and cortical regions. And what these Swedish neurochemists found through clever chemical techniques was that there were dopamine neurons in the brain, that was the first discovery, and that they projected into this area that was the stimulation probe hit in the rat. And it also projected to parts of the cortex. Well, it took another 40 years, actually, for somebody to decide to go and measure what was going on in these neurons, these dopamine neurons. And somebody named Wolfram Schultz did it in monkeys, and he was trying to study movement, and once again, he was his results did not meet his expectations. So he thought that when a monkey moves, these dopamine neurons will fire. And what he found was that the dopamine neurons were firing all the time, And they were very poorly behaved from an experimental standpoint, until he realized that he should have read Pavlov more closely, because Pavlov also found the same thing with dog salivation, and also found that he can enslave the salivatory response by presenting the dogs with a cue that indicated that they were going to get fed. So the salivation was not responding to the food itself, but to the cue that was presented. Schultz did the same thing, presented monkeys with a cue that indicated they were going to get juice, and suddenly these dopamine neurons started behaving in a predictable way. And what I mean by that is that if the monkey didn't know that the cue signaled juice, and it got juice, this is just a little recording of the firing of these neurons, and each line represents a different recording. These neurons would fire when the juice came. But once the monkey learned that association between the cue and the juice, so the cue could be like a sound or a shape on a screen, the firing moved to the cue presentation. And what he also noticed was that this was not just a surprise response. The neurons were sort of tracking something surprising that happened, because if he tricked the monkey, he presented the cue and then didn't give the monkey the juice, there was a decrease in the firing of these neurons, basically. So it seemed that these neurons were tracking not so much the receipt of something good, but the anticipation of something good, the prediction of something good. Now, these neurons, as I mentioned, project to many different regions in the brain. So this still doesn't resolve the issue of how these neurons are enlisting the animal's attention and focus and salivation and so forth to get it in a position where it can get the food or the good stuff. I won't go into detail on this, but the main thing I want to say about this is that all of these circuits are connected, and we're able to look at the anatomical connections between this region and this region and this region and this region, and they're all sort of connected in a circuit. And that circuit goes, roughly speaking, from deep down in the brain up here to your motor cortex, which is up here at the top of your head. So one idea about this circuit is that when you prime it with dopamine, then you get that animal's attention focused on something good and get it moving towards that thing so that it can grab it. And obviously this has adaptive significance, okay? And there's amazing science that's been done in the last 50 years to sort of carefully trace all these pathways, to understand the chemistry of what's going on. And still we don't have a good functional idea of exactly what the circuitry is doing. And this is where brain imaging comes in. So this is where the method that I use a lot, I use behavior quite a bit, and I also use functional magnetic resonance imaging comes in. And the reason that it's useful is because it gives you the temporal resolution on brain activity that is a second-to-second temporal resolution, which means you can look at what's happening in the brain, not just when somebody gets something good, but when they anticipate something good. If you think about going to the supermarket and choosing bread, I always have a hard time choosing bread. I don't know why. But you go to the supermarket and choose bread, you stand there and you see all that stuff. How long does that take? From the moment you got there to the moment you reached out and grabbed some bread, how long would you guys say it takes?
3 or 4 minutes.
You're like me. 3 or 4 minutes. Okay. Anybody else?
30 seconds.
30 seconds? Okay, well, that's pretty short.
5 seconds,
10 seconds? Yeah, I mean.
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Yeah, you guys are right on the end of the distribution, right? Just like me. I don't go to the store that much. I should. I don't. But, you know, most people kind of know what they're looking for, but they have to, you know, scan around. And even when they see it, they have to kind of figure out how to reach up there. You know, the minimum that that's going to take is, say, a second or two, right? It's going to take time. It's going to take time. And something has to happen in your brain to allow you to do that. Now, if we had a method that would allow us to look deep in the brain as you're thinking about that and doing it, then we could actually try to predict what you're going to do. Which loaf of bread are you going to reach for, right? Or are you going to get bread at all? So what you actually need is a method that allows you to look deep in the brain on a second-to-second basis, and that's what functional magnetic resonance imaging allows you to do, and that's not something that we could do before 1993. So this is a case of technology actually allowing us to answer questions that we couldn't even address before. And so at the time that functional magnetic resonance imaging became popular, I was at the National Institute of Health, and my advisor told me that we had time, our institute had time on this magnet, and would I like to use it for something? And I was very excited about that. At that time, people were just looking at sort of what I would call input and output. So input being, you know, flashing lights in your eyes and looking at your visual cortex, or output, looking at your motor cortex right before you're about to reach for something, okay? But I realized, and other people realized quickly, that you could look deep in the brain and get at some of these deep areas that we knew very little about. And so what I wanted to do is to get people emotional. I wanted people to get excited or anxious about something, and I used all kinds of different stimuli to try to do this. So just like in the monkey studies or the Pavlovian studies, we tried to use food or juice. That was very difficult. The juice dripped out of the mouth, and it's hard to squirt it into the mouth fast enough, and people swallowed and moved their heads. And I won't go into all the gory details, but we showed them pictures. I'll talk a little bit about pictures later. Turns out people have very different preferences for pictures. So some people like pictures of puppies, others don't. They like surgery or whatever else. So that was tough. So what we finally hit upon was money. That money really worked pretty well for most of our subjects. Most of our subjects were motivated to try to get money. We could scale it, so we could say, we're either going to give you a little bit or a lot. We could also take it away. That was really great because, that meant then it could either be positive or negative. And this is a really tricky dilemma if you're studying animals, right? So how many shocks does a dog have to overcome to get 3 squirts of food powder? It's incommensurate. But as humans, we have this great invention called money. So we used money, and we didn't just give it to people, but we actually cued them. And probably the dumbest video game that's ever been invented, that they might make money, okay? Or they might avoid losing money. So the way the video game works is people see a cue, they wait a couple of seconds, then they see a rapidly presented target, like a square, that flashes on the screen. They try to push the button before the target goes away. If they're fast enough, depending on what the cue indicates, they could make money. If they're not fast enough, they don't make anything. And if it's another type of a cue, like a square, they can avoid losing money. So if they're fast enough in that case, they would get 0. And if they're not fast enough, they would actually lose money. This is for real money. So you have people come into the lab. We show them the money. We found out this is very important. Because people are like, this is for real money? She just wasted $1,500 on a brain scanning experiment. So we show them the money. We pay them. We dole it out after they get out of the scanner. And they're really engaged in these tasks. And they get emotional about them. I mentioned that we can manipulate the cue, so we can manipulate expectation as well as the outcome. So here we have circles indicating you can make money, squares indicating you can lose money. We can manipulate how much is at stake. No lines means no dollars. We just want you to be a good sport and play along. One line means 20 cents is at stake, 2 lines a dollar, 3 lines $5 is at stake. So this is reasonable money, even in Palo Alto. You could probably buy a latte on that or something. If you were in my magnet, you might see this, and then you would see this, and then you would see that really fast, and if you're fast enough, you would have gotten $5, and I like that response over there, because that's what a lot of people do. They're like, woo, I got the $5. Or, oh, I just lost $5. And then you see what happened to your total. So people play this game as they're in the magnet. And the basic idea here is to use the signal that's in their brain to look at what happens, not only in response to getting the money or losing the money, but also when people think they might get the money, or they might lose the money. And the other thing I forgot to tell you is that we can control your success rates. So we can track how fast you are, right? And we can make those cues faster or slower, depending on how well you're doing, okay? So, and this is very important, because we don't want people to know they've already made the money. We want them to not be sure. And we want them to know they've lost the money. We want them not to be sure. And it turns out that it's much more engaging if it's hard, but not too hard. As you might readily understand if you're trying to make a game like this. So we basically can track people into performance, like 66% hits, for instance. And this tends to be very engaging for people. So that's how the task works. What do we see when we look inside the brains of people playing this task? And by the way, people are highly engaged. They don't fall asleep. They want to play more, so they come out of the magnet wanting to come back. So it's not hard to get subjects for these experiments. And they're able to keep their heads still, too. So which is important with fMRI. So what we see, and this is, I should point out, this is somebody's head, some nice subject who had a pretty brain. And we took their structural scan, and we cut it here, here, and here, and took the chunk out. So you can look into their brain, not only at their cortex, but also under their cortex, the subcortical areas. This is about the area that Olds was stimulating in that rat brain, or the rat was stimulating itself. And what we see, when people think they can make money, they haven't made anything yet, is increased activity in that area when they think they're going to make money. And we don't see the same increase in activity in that area when they think they're going to lose money. So we think we're onto something. The other reason we think we're onto something is because we know the dopamine is projecting to that area from the animal studies I just told you about. We're not looking at dopamine, we're looking at oxygen, which is a proxy for neurons firing. but we think that dopamine squirts out and probably changes what's going on in that area, the energy utilization. So what we can then do is we can say, okay, show me the data. Show me that before people responded, before they got the money, activity in that region is increasing. That's what fMRI is buying us, right? So this plot is a little complicated, but what it shows is the period when people saw the cues that they could make money. Here's the period where they're waiting to respond. Here's where they responded. Here's where they actually made the money. And what you see here is two things. The more money that people think they can make, here's a $0, 20 cents, $1, and $5 cue, the more activity you see in this region. And also, by the time they've actually made the money, it's going back to baseline. So if you don't have the temporal resolution to look at these stages of what's going on separately, you're going to miss the signal. If you average over this whole thing, you're not going to be able to see very much. The brain is responding fast. It's anticipating things fast, and it's flexible. And that should be no surprise to us, actually. But until we had this technology, we just couldn't see those changes in the signal. But that suggests something else, too, that we can take that signal and now use it to try to predict something that people will do. Before I go on, I just want to tie this back into emotion, because I told you that I was interested in emotion. And even though it seems like we've drifted far from that, I never really lost sight of that. So I'd ask people after they came out of the magnet, when you saw this cue that indicated you make it $5, how good did you feel? How aroused did you feel? How excited did you feel? When you ask people questions like that, you can plot their feeling in a sort of a two-dimensional space of valence and arousal. And you can see how far up, in this case, they go on this dimension that I'll call positive arousal. So this is like being excited, energetic, and so forth. It's what we think should correspond with dopamine release in this area. And what we see is that we're not looking at the money spot per se. We think we're looking at the excitement spot. So if you're a person that's very excited about making $5 and you report that and you see that cue, then you report that you were more excited and you show a bigger nucleus accumbens response. You show a bigger response in that brain area. Okay, so this is a person who is very excited about making $5 and they show a large response in this brain area. Whereas this person, faced with the same cue, wasn't as excited. Said, ah, whatever, I'm rich. Your nucleus accumbens isn't responding the same way. I said I'm rich, but actually doesn't. We found that wealth doesn't really matter that much. Some rich people are quite motivated. Other poor people, not so motivated. So.
Is that graph showing two
people? Oh, good question, yeah. So each of these dots is a person, is a subject in our study. And this is their excitement only when they're looking at that $5 cue. So this is really the biggest win cue. And then this y-axis indicates how much activity there is in that one area I showed you, the nucleus accumbens, when they see that $5 cue. So each of those dots is a person. And in fact, this task works pretty well, so a lot of people around the world have used it to see this brain area. And there are clinical reasons that you might want to see activity in this area, that you might want to see a neural marker of motivation that I won't go into, but I will say we've had pretty good success with collaborators in psychiatry looking at people with schizophrenia and other disorders where people suffer from deficits in motivation. When they play the same task and we get the same behavior from them, we see blunting of activity in these regions of the brain. And that's correlated with their self-reported amotivational symptoms. And we think this could be a good clue as to which kinds of either pharmacotherapy or psychotherapy these people could benefit from. So there is a clinical angle to this. And that's why I was doing this at the National Institute of Health. But I'm not really focusing on that today. I'm focusing more on moment-to-moment decisions. And I won't go into detail on this. I think I want to get to the prediction part of the talk. But you can change other things about the cue, about the expectation. So you can make people expect there's a high probability they'll win or a low probability. It turns out that's really relevant to a lot of economic ways of thinking about how people should decide. That probability and magnitude go together to form something called expected value. And that you can use it to gamble efficiently, too. And it also turns out that many of these regions that dopamine projects to are activated when people expect higher probabilities of making money, but not to the same extent. So it seems that the prefrontal cortex is more attuned to probability, whereas the subcortical region that I just talked about, the nucleus accumbens, is more in tune with magnitude. And the reason that we think this is important is because if you lose your prefrontal cortex, we think that will make you make decisions that may be insensitive to probability. So, for instance, that it may make you more likely to play the lottery, where there's a very small probability of winning a very large amount. And I won't go into that anymore, but I just want to point out that there are some clinical implications of this work. So many people have done these studies. Here's a meta-analysis. That means just putting a whole bunch of the same studies together and looking for common patterns. And these patterns are quite robust, actually. Using money in Germany, Japan, England, and so forth, people show the same kinds of responses where you get a bigger activity in this subcortical region, the nucleus accumbens, when people think they can gain money than when they think they can lose money. And the region, and there are other regions that we think that are important for anticipating loss. They're not as clear in our data, and there may be physiological reasons for that. We're still working on that. But what this does is it gives us markers. It gives us neural markers for when we think people are anticipating good outcomes and when we think they're anticipating bad outcomes. And armed with those markers, we can start to make predictions, not just about how people will feel, but what they will choose. So this is the prediction part of the talk, right? So we're moving away from the traditional way of thinking about brain imaging, where you show people things and look for correlated activity in their brain. Now what we're saying is, okay, forget what's going in, let's look at what's happening in the brain, and let's make a prediction about what they're going to do next. One area where we can make these kinds of predictions is financial risk taking. Another is shopping, and so we'll talk about those next. This is our rough back of the napkin model for what we think is happening. So we think that when people show more activity in certain parts of their brain, like the nucleus accumbens, they will see the upside of a proposition, of, say, a gamble, or even a consumer purchase decision. And when you see activity in other regions, they're going to be paying more attention to potential losses. And depending on the balance of activity in those regions, we can predict whether people are more likely to approach or avoid something. Okay, so that's going to be a theme that's in the second part of the talk about prediction. So I'm going to start actually with probably not the most straightforward example. I'm going to start with financial risk-taking. And the reason I'm going to start with it is because chronologically that's what we started investigating first, because I had a student from finance who decided she wanted to do neuroeconomics research and came up with this really cool study. And she actually wrote it up as a paper in my class, and I said, hey, let's do this, and so we naively did it. But what she wanted to do was simulate investing. And this is not trivial, but she came up with a really interesting task to do this. And in this task, it's sort of a stripped-down version of investing. Basically, you're trying to decide between three options, two risky options, two stocks, and a bond. And you know something about these options, so you know that the good stock is going to pay off $10 with about a 50% probability, but 25% of the time, you're going to lose $10. Conversely, the bad stock, you're going to lose $10 50% of the time and gain $10 25% of the time. And the bond, if you choose that, you'll always make a dollar. Okay. And what people do is they choose between these, then they see the outcomes, they learn, hopefully, and then they go to the next trail and they choose again. Okay. And what this test does is it elicits all kinds of behaviors from people. People will choose from the stocks, then maybe they'll go back to the bond, then they'll go back to the stocks again. And what we want to know is what's happening in their brain right before they make these choices. Is there something that happens in their brain that's like a switch that makes them go to the high-risk options rather than the low-risk options, or vice versa? Based on what I've said, you know kind of where we're looking, but I'll review that. So if you were in my magnet, you might see these three options, the two stocks and a bond. You don't know which is the good and which is the bad stock. Say you choose stock T. You wait, and you see that you just made $10, and your total is now $20, okay? You also see, and this is important, that if you would have chosen stock R, you would have made $0. Okay, so that's more information. So that means the next time you choose, that may actually influence what you do next. Again, what we're interested in is not so much what's happening here when they choose, but what's happening in their brain right before they choose. And the reason we made the task this way is because this task allows you to calculate what a rational actor would do. So, and we mean rational actor in the finance sense of the word. So a risk-neutral Bayesian updating actor. That is somebody with perfect memory, remembers everything that happened, and is able to weight those events and come up with the optimal solution. Unless you think this is kind of a silly model, this is the kind of model that's used to choose yours and my retirement portfolios, if they still exist. So, you know, this is a commonly accepted model in finance. And it's really cool because what it allows us to do is operationalize rationality and irrationality, right? So we can say, when did people do something that was consistent with the rational actor, and when did they do something that was inconsistent? I won't go into great detail there, and I won't go into great detail here. I just want to make one point, and that is, if you look at what's happening in that nucleus accumbens region that the rats were self-stimulating right before they're about to make a pick, it turns out that if there's more activity in that region, you're more likely to take a risk. And the more activity there is, the more likely you are to take an irrational risk. That is, to choose the stock when the rational actor is not choosing the stock. It's not totally irrational. That is to say, even when you're making a rational risky choice, there's more activity in the accumbens. Conversely, in this other region that I pointed out that's a little more to the side, the insula, when there's more activity in that region, you're more likely to avoid the risk and just choose the bond. And if there's even more activity in that region, you're more likely to take an irrational risk, make an irrational choice to avoid risk. Okay, so it's almost like there are two levers. One steers you this way, one steers you that way. If you go too far, you know, your forklift turns over. So you kind of need the levers to steer the forklift, but you don't want to go too far one way or the other. So this tells us some interesting facts. It tells us, we think, that if we're associating what's happening in these regions with emotion, that emotion is really important, actually, for making rational decisions, but there needs to be a balance. And if there's not a balance, you'll become extreme and make irrational decisions. Here's a set of decisions that many of you are probably more familiar with. I know I am. Shopping. This is a set of experiments I did with George Lowenstein, who's a behavioral economist at Carnegie Mellon, and Drajan Krulic, who's at MIT. And this was a very simple experiment. All we wanted to do is get people to shop in the Met. But again, it's the same idea as before. We want to take their brain activity before they actually make the choice and see if we can use that activity to predict what they're about to do. And you already know where I'm going to be looking in the brain based on what I've said. But what we did is we gave people money, $40. And we said, you're going to be looking at 80 products at discounted prices. On each one, you're going to have the opportunity to buy that product at that price or not and indicate that. And at the end of the experiment, we're going to draw two of these for real. And we're going to look at what you did. And if you said yes, then you give us the money and we'll give you the product plus change. And if no, you keep the money. This is what economists call incentive compatible. So if you're in my magnet, you might see something like this. And you would see something like that, the price. And then you would have an opportunity to say yes or no. And if you're me, you'll say yes. Not everybody will. And then you wait and you go to the next trial. So it's sort of like doing Sky Mall on the Magnet or something like that, or the Amazon. So what did we see in this experiment? Well, actually, we did see that when people saw products, especially products they liked, we saw more activity in this nucleus accumbens region that I've been talking about that we associate with anticipating gains. But when they saw prices they didn't like, and I can give you more information about how we calculated that, we saw more activity in this insula region. So it's sort of the opposite pattern of activation. And what we also saw is that we could use the brain activation after the experiment. I'll just rewind a little bit and say, we asked people, which of these products did you like? And they rated each of the products. And we asked them, how much would you be willing to pay for each of the products? What we could do is then subtract how much they were willing to pay from the price they saw and get what I call a bargain versus ripoff metric, but an economist would call a consumer surplus metric. And we were able to correlate both of those with brain activation. And we found that those two things did a good job of predicting what people would want to buy or not. But if we just took that data and threw it away and just looked at what was happening in the brain, in these three regions, the nucleus accumbens, a part of the prefrontal cortex, and the insula, we also found we could significantly predict whether people were going to buy something or not. So this is before they've indicated their choice. And we also found that when you put these two things together, the self-report and the brain activity, the self-report doesn't rule out the significance of the brain activity. So this is a situation where people self-report and brain activity is actually correlated, as we've shown. But there might be situations where there's not a correlation. So for instance, when people encounter something novel that they've never bought before, or maybe they have conflicted desires about something like a hamburger, but they're on a diet, and so forth. So these are instances that Kelly's writing about in her new book that you should buy, that others are starting to look at, and those are much more interesting. Here we were just trying to ask the question, can we use the brain activation to predict what people are going to do? And the answer is yes. And this, it doesn't matter if we focus on these specific areas that I talked about, or we use data from the whole brain at each time point to predict what people are going to do. So here's a whole brain method that basically doubles our prediction rate with the same data. And what we see is that when people see products, The area that predicts that they're going to buy something is this nucleus accumbens area. Once they see the price, boom, you see the cortex get engaged. You see that these areas in the prefrontal cortex that we think are doing a cost-benefit balance are predicting now. And this other area we weren't paying attention to in the posterior cingulate that we think has something to do with attention. And by the time they've actually made the choice, when they're making the choice, the predictive power is gone. So this is all happening before. This is all happening in your brain seconds before you make a choice. And it's, and I can't stress enough that the technological advances are actually critical for us to see this. Now, since we did this not so long ago, 2007, a number of other labs have found similar results and have found other interesting things. So, for instance, they found that even if you distract people... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Did you actually ask people what they experienced the milliseconds before they made their choices?
We did ask them in a way. So we asked them how much they preferred each product, and then we asked them how willing they were to pay each price. But we didn't ask how they were feeling, which would be very interesting, I think. So that's something we'd like to look at.
Why did you do
that? Because we have to do them separately. If we ask them in the magnet, then we believe that the reflective processing will impinge upon the activation that we're seeing and might change it. So it's sort of like a Heisenberg uncertainty principle issue. That by reflecting on the very process you're studying, you actually change the process. And there's some evidence for that, actually. So that if you're in an emotional episode, especially one of these anticipatory affective states, and you get people to reflect, that it actually starts to change what's going on. So one way to do that would be before the experiment to ask people, you know, how are they reacting to everything. But we didn't want to bias their choices. We just wanted it to be as naturalistic as possible. And that's why we asked them after the experiment. But of course, these are all interesting questions that need to be explored. And some of them have to do with how wary are you of what's going on, you know, even emotionally. Like, and maybe that most people aren't aware until after, the experimenter comes with their clipboard and says, how did you feel when you saw that product, you know? And I suspect that's probably the case because, remember, these are regions of the brain that we share for the most part with rats and dogs and monkeys and so forth. Who may be somewhat reflective, but not to the same extent that humans are. And in fact, that's relevant to these replications where investigators distracted people and showed them things that they might buy, like auto cars in Germany and so forth, and were able to derive the same prediction regardless of what people were specifically attending to. There's an interesting set of issues also, not just about how much conscious reflection is required, but also about even if you can do this in individuals, does it scale to the aggregate? So that is to say, could you use some focus group of people in the magnet and their preferences to make inferences about the market? And one really provocative example of this is by Greg Burns, who will be speaking here probably in this room on Wednesday, where they looked at people's neural responses to songs that were on MySpace, I believe. It was MySpace. A defunct social network. maybe not yet, but... and then 3 years later, they looked at market data. They looked at RIAA ratings of these songs and were able to use, actually, the nucleus accumbens response to these clips of these songs to predict which songs would be the hits. So that's pretty crazy, but it suggests that at least some of these processes may scale to the aggregate. These are obviously hard studies to do, and that needs to be replicated. What are the implications of not only understanding how brain activity is correlated to what's out there, but also how it can predict what we're going to do? And I think there are many. Some of the theoretical implications are that we may be able to construct a theory of decision making that A, involves emotion, and B, goes beyond the theories that we have so far. So I'll give you a couple of examples of that briefly. So for instance, many of theories of finance consider the expected value of a stock, so that means how well it did in the past, how well you think it's going to do in the future. And also the variance, the variability of that stock. So if it's going up and down and up and down, most people tend not to want that to happen. So they'll pay to have stability in their stocks. But they don't consider things like skewness, and this is another statistical property of stocks. So skewness means that you might have the stock rise to a very high value, but it only does that once, right? So this means actually very high magnitude, low probability events, like I mentioned the lottery earlier. Only one person's going to win the lottery. They're going to win a lot of money, but it's very unlikely that it's going to be you. And so the negative, the expected value of that lottery ticket is probably negative when you buy it, okay? Mathematically. But yet people buy lottery tickets, okay? People gamble. People do this stuff. So why? Why do they do that? There isn't really a great finance theory that can account for this behavior. And Nicholas Nassim Taleb has talked about skewness and kurtosis in higher statistical moments in his book, The Black Swan. You might have heard of that. Because there was a sort of an outlier, a skewed or kurtotic event that occurred just not so long ago in the financial markets where there was, I don't even understand fully exactly what happened, but basically there were over-leveraged types of options and there was basically a devaluing of those options and there was a financial crisis around the world that we're still recovering from. So to try to illustrate this more concretely, consider these gambles. Let's say I offer you this gamble right here. You have this amount of chance of, I've got a spinner, of making $1.75, but you have this amount of chance of losing $5.25. How many of you would take that gamble? Good. We have at least one person. Good. Thank you. Okay, good. Okay, how about this gamble? 50% chance of winning $3.05 and 50% chance of losing $3.05. How many would take that gamble? Great, more of you. Okay, good, good. So I'd say, you know, about 10% or less. How about this gamble? Yeah, this amount of chance of making $5.25, but this amount of chance of losing $1.75. How many would take that gamble? Okay, even more. Not that many more, but like 20%. Some of you are kind of like, oh, maybe I would, maybe I wouldn't. Okay, good. So it turns out these gambles are mathematically equivalent. Their expected value is zero, okay? And that's just math. I mean, I'm not tricking you when I say this, okay? But it turns out that this is the kind of preference that most people have. Most people prefer this gamble to that gamble. This is a positive skewed gamble, because it has a low likelihood positive outcome, and this is a negative skewed gamble, low likelihood negative outcome. But these are all mathematically equivalent, okay? So if you know that and you're a trader, you can arbitrage that. You can trade against that, basically. And people do. There are instruments that trade against this. But that's not the point I'd like to make. The point I'd like to make is that we've just done an experiment where we put people in the magnet and we asked them, would you like to take this gamble or not? Either you take this gamble or you just get zero. That's it. And we look at what happens in the brain before they do that. And when we do that, lo and behold, we are able to predict that more people will take this gamble because there's more nucleus accumbens activation before they take it. Why? Because they're focused on that game. They're not thinking about probability. That's what we think is going on, and they're excited. This is not the case when they choose this gamble. So we don't see as much activity, and in fact, we start to see deactivation of the insulin. We can also predict individual risk preferences. Some people who raise their hands really like this gamble. Those people are going to have more nucleus accumbens activation before they choose that gamble. All I'm trying to illustrate here is that we can use this data to go beyond these stand theories and maybe make a more comprehensive theory that can actually explain and predict human choice. Here's another weird example. This is far out. So in this experiment, we asked people to choose between a low and a high-risk gamble. And by that, I mean one gamble is a 50-50 chance of making or losing 10 cents, and this gamble is a 50-50 chance of winning or losing a dollar. And they just chose this over and over again. But the trick was we also put pictures in front of the gambles. Okay? And there were three kinds of pictures that we put in front of the gambles. One type was erotic, tamed by our internet standards, right? But couples making out, sort of not fully clothed. Another set of pictures was snakes and spiders, basically. And a third set of pictures was of office supplies. Okay, so you can immediately sense that, you know, the heterosexual college students who are males that were in our study liked these pictures, the erotic pictures, better than the snakes and spiders or the office supplies, obviously. And so what was our hypothesis? Well, our hypothesis was, let's trick the system. Let's jack that nucleus accumbens response and make the gain salient. And if we do that, then people are going to take the high-risk gamble. Why? Because it has a bigger gain. It has a bigger loss, too. But that's not what they're paying attention to. So indeed, that's what we saw. And not only did we see that, but we also saw that those people who were really susceptible to this influence, when they saw the sexy picture, they took the risky gamble, had more activation in their nucleus accumbens right after they saw the sexy picture and before they took the risky gamble. So this is some statistical evidence that there's some sort of a pathway through your brain that can trick your brain, really, because these are, again, the expected value of these gambles is always zero. And by the way, people are, it's the same person, it's the same gamble, and they're flipping around their choices, right? So it doesn't make any sense from an economic standpoint, but yet we can predict and manipulate this. And we're not doing this because we're nefarious and we're trying to manipulate people, but we're doing this because we think this is how the system works. And so in order to test our theory, we actually have to go in there and show that we can change things. All right, so just to summarize everything I've said, we think that neural activity related to anticipatory affect, so that's the kind of emotion that you would feel when you're anticipating an outcome, an uncertain outcome. We can localize it with fMRI, but not only that, we can use it to predict decisions. Financial decisions, at least, and we think other kinds of decisions too, like social decisions. These predictions extend beyond those made by standard economic and psychological theories, we believe. And so they could pave the way to having a better theory of how people make decisions and a better self-understanding of how of our idiosyncrasies in making decisions. That's our hope. There are so many questions that are unanswered. There are more questions than answers at this point. So, for instance, can other circuits, so sort of your habits you form, maybe symbolic systems, rule-based systems in your brain, override these systems. When do they do that? Do they have to act through these emotional circuits, or can they go around them? We don't know. We have the tools, though, to start asking these questions. Can the individual influences that we see here scale to the group level, and if so, when? And this would obviously have implications not only for psychology, but also for economics. So in closing, this lecture was actually not supposed to be about my work, although it was. I apologize for that. It was supposed to be about thinking like a psychologist, so I just want to end on that. Chances are you're all thinking like psychologists, and almost everybody out there is. How can we avoid it, right? You know, we observe what other people are doing. We describe what they are doing, maybe to other people. We come up with explanations. But the difference is, if you want to think like an experimental psychologist, you have to go the extra mile. So you have to not just say, okay, I believe in the rational actor, that's my explanation, done. That's how people either are or should be. And you can't say, I think people are emotional, and that's all that matters. Okay, that just doesn't lead anywhere, you know? You actually have to say, okay, there are different theories here. I may not be right. I may not be right about this emotional thing. Maybe people are rational. Let's actually test our prediction. And if we're not right, then we need to revise our prediction, because only then can we actually control and apply what we've learned to ourselves and to the real world. With that, I'd like to thank my collaborators, Camelia Kunin, Shelley Wu, and Peter Bossertz. These are my finance collaborators, George Lowenstein, and Drajan Prelik, who are essential for the shopping work, my lab, which is just fantastic. It's here. I love them to death. And my funding agencies and you for sitting through this great long talk.
We're going to take a 10-minute break and then come back for a conversation.